I'm here chatting to Jane for as well today, and we are going to have a conversation about the current world around SEN, special educational needs and disabilities, and children, young people, and their families too, I guess. So, yeah, Jane, what do you think is happening at the moment in the current landscape around inclusion in education?
I think what's happening in the current landscape around inclusion, particularly within education, is the short answer to that is not enough. And I'll go on to explain why I believe not enough is happening. Our focus for many, many years, largely since the whole notion of having a code of practice for special educational needs, which occurred on the back of Education Act legislation, which took place in the 90s, we've had a focus on actually schools' responsibilities in better understanding the needs of children who learn differently to the vast majority of children and young people. So this notion of inclusion in education is not a concept in itself. So the concept of inclusion is much, much bigger and greater than just simply thinking about it through the lens of education. So we had Gavin Williamson, the Secretary of State for Education, allocating an extra £780 million to local authority higher needs budgets, for example, for this new financial year, 2020-21. But this really is an indication, I suppose, of the continuing what I would call sticking plaster approach that simply doesn't address this sort of perfect storm, almost double perfect storm, if you like, of both a funding crisis for SEND, because we know around about 80-82% of local authorities across England, and these are the latest figures from the Local Government Association survey, are in significant difficulty and are managing significant overspends with regards to the higher needs budget allocation. So it's almost like being brought about by the unintended consequences of anti-inclusion government policy in
Yeah.
England. And I think we one of the big errors that we made back in the reform period of 2014, we operated on this presumption of inclusion. And there was a almost a level of lip service that was being paid to inclusion at that time, that legislation was going on the statute book. And really, it placed no accountabilities or provided any incentives on schools to become more inclusive.
But I was sort of thinking about the work that we've done where, where we've kind of supported local areas. And particularly, I mean, there's a couple of things I wanted to pick out. One was around those schools where they believe in inclusion and they make it happen because it's the right thing to happen. And I guess what sits alongside that for me is the role of leaders and leadership. And I didn't know whether whether you had any thoughts around that. Are leaders, are they made or do they have it in them innately? Or how is it that we have some really strong school leaders who believe in inclusion and make it happen alongside all of the constraints and challenges that you've described around high needs budget and everything else that they've got stacked against them, the curriculum, the inspection framework, etc., etc. Yet some leaders manage to make it happen. What is that about, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's down to the response and the development of more ethical leadership within education. And I think it's also about being very much seen and having a self-belief in being a values-led leader. And being a values-led leader isn't just about saying, I believe in this, I value you. It's actually about putting what you value into action. And that actually is a really inclusive way of operating. And I think as leaders in schools, and I don't just mean heads and senior leaders, so I include governors in that too. I mean, leadership at every single level is about being visible as a leader through the way in which you behave, because it's our behaviour that enables us to play out our values, to actually demonstrate how, you know, the values by which we choose to live our lives by. So I think, you know, those values into action, being an ethical leader, being a leader who's visible, being a leader who understands that, you know, every life and sadly, you know, in these times, every death mm-hmm. has an equal worth, you know,
yeah.
that we are yeah, all, absolutely. You know, we are all equal.
Yeah.
And supporting absolutely. People to feel that they absolutely belong, you know, to the society that we all inhabit, that we all contribute to, that we all enjoy the benefits of. You know, I really believe, Julie, that every school leader does the best that they possibly can.
Yeah.
But of course, they're often reliant on the support structures that are in place at local level.
I think one of the challenges, and it came out very clearly in the NAO report, is around that shifting culture. And I'm wondering whether you feel that we've almost focused too much on system and process and not on values and culture.
If I had a pound for every time I ask the following question in most local areas in England, and I'll say, you know, what does inclusion mean to you in your local area? What does it look like? What does it feel like?
Yeah.
What does it look like from you as a from you looking through your head teacher lens, you looking through your parent lens, you looking through your young person's lens, you looking through your commissioner lens, you looking through your health lens, your social care lens? So what does that look like? Sadly, I'm not surprised anymore, because often the response is, we've never really thought about it like that, Jane, before. So I think the very conversation that you and I are having now, there's a huge amount of assumption that that's actually taking place at local level.
Yeah, when
I don't think it is. And I think we need to stimulate that.
Yeah.
And I think NDTI are in a phenomenal place to be able to act as the stimulant to get those conversations going, and to really enable local areas and local leaders to better articulate what their inclusive values into action look like.
Yeah, and I guess that's why we kind of pulled together 100 Days for Inclusion, because that programme is about having exactly those conversations that you've just described. Moving on, we can't really have this conversation without addressing COVID-19. You know, we're in a really... a really difficult situation at the moment, and as you've already alluded to, you know, a lot of questions around how lives are valued, which you know, it is very upsetting, very distressing for me, but I suppose, or for all of us, my question is around, do you feel like we might have some opportunities when we come out the other end, certainly in relation to curriculum and how school is delivered, now that, you know, we've had a very different schooling scenario across the world, not just in this country? Might it mean that there is more opportunity for inclusion?
I really hope so, Julie. I mean, I can only speak personally that since the lockdown, the arrangements, since the lockdown arrangements have been in place, I have found personally, and to a small extent professionally too, a greater level of social interest in community building, you know, and also an essence of taking on a greater level of social responsibility. And I think there's also an interesting irony as well that's been crystallised, I think, for many, that whilst we've been separated very much from each other as members of our immediate communities, our families, our neighbour, you know, our neighbourly groups, our wider community groups. So whilst there's been that high degree of separation, I think there's also a sense of togetherness that seems stronger than ever. So it's quite ironic, isn't it, in a way?
It is ironic. I think something that really struck me, actually, and I hadn't even given it much thought, to be honest, but, you know, as you know, a lot of what we do, particularly around Preparing for Adulthood, is about employment and employment pathways. And it was my son who said, you know, isn't it strange, Mum, that now have a situation where people have to work from home, suddenly everyone's able to work from home. Surely that means that, you know, job opportunities should be available for people with a disability if Absolutely. We're able to make these reasonable adjustments around COVID-19.
Absolutely. Yeah,
yeah, it, quite yeah. interesting, quite an interesting conversation
yeah. Yeah. to have. Yeah. And I think that's there's got to be and there will be an opportunity to have a I feel like a national level of reflection on the outcomes of our COVID-19 experience as an entire nation and I think we there's a lot that's working well at the moment, Julie, and a great example of that is today, you know, in my street it's bin day today. So, you know, bins were put out mostly last night, early hours of this morning, and the bins have been emptied and collected. But actually, we've got a high proportion of retired, mature citizens who live in our streets. So the kids in our streets have gone around putting notes through doors, offering to put bins out and return bins when they've been emptied.
Oh, that's
for those
brilliant.
that are in shielding arrangements.
That's you so know, cool.
But I just think that's brilliant, isn't it? I mean, yeah. it's such a great practical, pragmatic response yeah. to the situation that some of our neighbours find themselves in. Now, some of our neighbours enjoy the benefits of having good neighbourly relationships anyway, and were perhaps receiving that level of support anyway without a coronavirus pandemic having to prompt that. But I think what was really enlightening for me was having a conversation with one of those kids this morning who was doing, you know, the bin collections and putting them away. Some of the kids are taking it upon themselves to get the hose pipe out and give the bins a wash so that they were being returned clean. So they were running with it, running with this idea, and it was fantastic. and next week, you know, a couple of the lads were saying to me this morning, you know, what we want to do is we want to, that some of the numbers on the sides of the wheelie bins aren't that clear, and we do think they need improving. So we're going to repaint some of the numbers on the bins for the neighbours that need it.
Brilliant.
And again, you know, so, and I just sat there partly in awe of what I was hearing, but also complete admiration. And I had a real sense of sort of civic pride, if you like, in being part of that conversation and listening to those young people who recognise that they've got an opportunity. They were literally being agents of social change. And that's what we were talking about this morning. And that's what we need. We need to think about the amount of social change opportunities that the pandemic has provided us with. And I think whenever we've recognised that there almost feels to be that barrier from within for those leaders that we are inspiring to go out and be those agents of change around, you know, promoting inclusion and becoming a much more increasingly inclusive local area. We, you know, our response, both through the NDTI leadership programme, but also more generally as leaders in our own right, has been to mobilise, you know, to mobilise and promote momentum and to gather momentum. And the way in which the leadership programme's done that really strongly is through the alumni network, through keeping people connected, through sharing. You know, when I come across a particular barrier, it's always great to actually hook up with, you know, folks in other local areas that might be having similar struggles to myself or similar challenges to myself. So it is about mobilising that local level of support and you know, banding together, you know, creating your agents of change team, you know, your tribe, if you like.
Can we just have a bit of a chat about families, young people and families, because I'm always struck when we do work in local areas and we talk to families about inclusion that I believe that it is what most families want for their children and young people, but they've lost a bit of faith and a bit of confidence in it actually happening and happening in the way that it needs to happen. You know, I think there's been kind of concern around bullying or around young people not being properly supported if they're in an inclusive environment. I suppose my question is, what do you think we need to do to get the faith and the trust back from families?
I think we've got to start with our providers and our commissioners. I think we've really got to challenge our local commissioners of the services that we're enabling families to access, and say to commissioners and those that we are commissioning to provide services, let's look at the value base on which those decisions are being made. So so for example, you know, as a parent of a young person with additional needs who was educated through entirely through the mainstream education system, but on a number of occasions throughout his school life, we were offered alternatives, the special school option, which for us, we felt, and for him, felt that it was not the appropriate step to take. But that was very much seen as the only solution. You know, that because things got so tough in mainstream, then actually the only other opportunity was a separate segregated educational experience within a local special school. There was never any talk about how schools might be able to work together. There was never any talk about, you know, how we could use his experience, our son's experience, to build and consolidate relationships between, you know, taking rather an eclectic view, really, of how services and provision can develop.
It's so that what would it take question, isn't it, really?
Well, the what we offer to our families needs to be malleable, needs to be flexible. We need to be able to shape it differently. Yeah. And I can remember talking to a colleague up in the Northwest many, many years ago, who I can remember her saying to me, "Jane, I've cracked the curriculum." She was a local head of a special school, and she said, "I've nailed it. I've got the curriculum. We've worked so hard on our curriculum." And we had the following conversation, and I said, "That's great." I said, "So you're confident that the cohort that are coming in September," I said, you've got the curriculum for right for your new cohort." And she said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, you see, it's the children that determine the curriculum offer for me. It's not the other way around." So as a former special school head, I would always look at pupil need as being the main imperative for how we designed our curriculum offer. And this colleague of mine up in the Northwest said, "But you must be changing your curriculum all the time." And I said,
"And yeah." He said, "Yes,
we are." I said, "It's great. It's really exciting. It's really innovating. Yeah. It keeps everything really fresh."
Yeah.
And actually, what we do is we constantly learn each, you know, mode or version that we present to our pupil cohort. I said, "Is slightly different again." I said, "But every time we do that, we improve what we offer."
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so I think there's a boldness about that that I think we haven't perhaps encapsulated well enough at local level, but perhaps gives a degree of confidence, or could give a degree of confidence to families to get in on that, to get in on that boldness of being, you know, family leaders, really.
Yeah, and I guess it's I know you talked about it earlier on, it's that looking at everyone's responsibility in the world of kind of inclusion. I'm sort of just thinking about the 100 days program again. I was going to ask you why you think it's important now, but one of the thoughts that came into my head was that, you know, part of the program for us is actually tapping into those areas of expertise. So you talked again about how we need to have around the table those people who are working in a special school setting, who have got good skills and expertise to support other schools to ensure that they become more inclusive. And I suppose my thought was around, you know, why do we think that's more important now than it's ever been?
Because the indicators, Julie, are really quite overwhelming, that things are not improving and are not improving quickly enough. So, you know, so with regards to our belief as an organisation, as NDTI, that every life has equal value. And you know, also recognising that the current landscape, education providers failing to meet their legal duties, even under the Equalities Act, even with that, you know, that level of reasonable adjustments duty that we know that all schools and all service providers must have in place with regard to disabled children and young people children and young people with additional needs. Mm-hmm. So I think the evidence base is the key driver here. You know, the increase on the number of children and young people who now require an education, health and care plan. 35% in 5 years. It's shocking, you know, and it's not simply about the increasing complexity of need. There is some small pools of evidence that suggests that complexity of need is a contributor to that overall increase of children, young people requiring education, health and care plans.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, at the same time, we've got the number of kids and young people being mm-hmm. educated in special schools rising by yeah. around about 24-25%.
Yeah.
You know, now that can't be right, can it? Because that certainly isn't an inclusive outcome. You know, that's an outcome that's saying the higher the level of need, the more you're likely to need a plan. And actually, it's a one-way route to a special school education. Now, I'm not saying that's intrinsically wrong, but what I am saying is that certainly isn't an inclusive model.
So, Jane, do you think inclusion starts in school?
I think inclusion starts at home. It starts within the family, and part of that family experience is education. And I think schools are our absolute clear vehicles, drivers. My son calls them, you know, he talks about his inclusive life journey as getting on the bus. And he describes it as a bus journey that's, you know, people get on the bus and stay with him for certain parts of the journey and then they get off again. Yeah. And it could be all changed. And sometimes he feels like the only person on that bus. Other times, you know, the bus is full. Yeah. And I like that analogy. I like that idea. And I think schools have the most fundamental. And when I talk about schools, I think about schools in its broadest sense. I'm thinking about early years settings,
yeah,
I'm thinking about childminders, schools, colleges, training providers, employers, that whole life provision that is available to all of our children, young people. But actually, from an inclusion perspective, schools absolutely are they're beyond the training ground. They're beyond the rehearsal room for inclusion. But actually, if we simply do not get inclusion right within education and within your local school offer, then as soon as our children leave the wonderful, you know, caring and loving arms of local schools and go out into the world of work, then actually, you know, I think we're now adopting a bit of a wing and a prayer approach to inclusion. If we don't get that right, if we don't get that quality of education, that quality of inclusive education off the right within our schools, then I think life just becomes an increasing struggle for our children.
And I think we're missing out on the gift, skills, talents, uniqueness of this group of children and young people that have so much to teach others as well.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we do that, you know, at a huge cost. When I think about, you know, the amazing talents of young people that have I've had the great privilege of working with, of supporting, of teaching over the last nearly 35 years, Julie, and their families, I have probably learnt much more from them than perhaps they've learnt from me at times.
Thank you so much, Jane. I've really enjoyed that conversation.
And I have too, Julie. Thank you.
I'm going to end it here. Thank you very much.